We are studying the book of Samuel, and I'm on page 49, and we're in 1 Samuel 13, 15 to 23. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying at Geba of Benjamin when the Philistine camp, while the Philistine camped at Michmash. The raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company toward Ophrah, which should look somewhat familiar with him, to the land of Shual, and another company toward Beth Oren, and another company toward the border, which overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Now, no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said this previously, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears, they will not have not allow blacksmiths. This is not at all uncommon. We did this to the Germans after World War I. But the Philistines had forbidden blacksmiths, and it wasn't the first time. If you remember, one of the things that happened when Samson was the judge was that the Philistines had forbidden blacksmiths in the land, and the Israelites had to go up to the Philistines to get their sickles sharpened for their harvest, because they weren't allowed it. So that being the reason, that being the case, all Israel went down. The Philistine ceased to sharpen his plowshares, mattock, his axe, or his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, and the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. So it came out on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but there were found with Saul and his son Jonathan, and the garrison of Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. So there are 600 men, and they've got three troops of Philistines on the march toward them. And of the 600 men of Israel, only two of them have an iron weapon, Jonathan and Saul. The rest of them have hay forks and big stones and slingshots, and that's what they have. You remember that after World War II, we put a big thing on the Germans that they could not make certain kinds of materials, and there was all these inspectors and whatever. And for years, that's what happened. It actually happened that way. But once people like Hitler convinced the German people that it was unfair and that it was a conspiracy against them, then the German people helped conspire. So the inspectors would come to an automobile plant, and as soon as they leave, they'd roll out the cars and roll in the tanks, which they'd had hidden back in the woods. So when Hitler showed up with all of his equipment, the West dropped their jaw because they had no idea that he had that kind of armaments, because we had forbidden the Germans from being able to build weaponry and whatever. So it was important for Israel to properly invoke the Lord, because Israel was severely outgunned. Saul and Jonathan had only 600 men left, and they had no iron weapons to speak of. The Philistines, I think I've covered all that. So the Philistines surrounded Saul's army, and Israel fled to the hills of Benjamin to survive, and Saul holed up in the hill country of Gibeah, his home and capital. Now, one of the things about Israel, particularly in Judea, was the nature of the hill countries that they lived there, and all of the caves and whatnot that were there. So throughout Jewish history, whenever they would come under attack, if they were outnumbered or whatever, they would go to the hills, go to the caves, and they would live in those caves. And it was very easy for a small number of men to defend those caves, because the people have to climb up the cliffs in order to get to them. And unless they could lure them out, you know, their enemy couldn't do anything with them. Down the plains, they could easily get overwhelmed, but up in the caves, they were fine. In fact, there's when the temple was destroyed, that people, when you went to the caves, that all of people's golden idols and all their wealth and everything were laying on the floor in the middle of bat dung, because people had run from Jerusalem to save themselves, and they'd carried all their valuables with them. Well, the problem is you know, that's all heavy stuff, and besides, you can't eat it. And so as they went along, they had discard stuff, and they started discarding all these heavy things like golden idols and whatever. It's exactly like what happened when people left St. Louis, Missouri in a Conestoga wagon, and they've got pianos on the back of their wagon, and they've got bedsteads, and they've got all kinds of stuff, you know, and maybe they've got 2 dozen trees and whatever. And by the time they pull into California, where they wind up, you know, all they've got is the clothes on their back and what they can carry in a sack. And they've left all, the Oregon Trail was just littered with all of the treasures of the people who left there and their relatives who they buried along the way. You know, they would have gotten there sooner and probably in much better shape and healthier as a people if they hadn't started off with all that weight and stuff that they had. So at any rate, Jonathan and Saul have got to seek the Lord because they have no chance to win this battle without God's help. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young men who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistine garrison that is on yonder side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men, and Ahijah the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, son of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone, and between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp crag on one side, a sharp crag on the other, and the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Senna. And the one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other on south opposite Geba. Saul was supposed to be guided at Gibeah by Ahijah, the high priest. He was one of the grandsons of Eli. He was a faithful man of God, as is later seen in 1 Samuel 22. He was not giving Saul the answers he wants, so Saul quit seeking the Lord. You know, these stories are told several times in the Bible, whether you're in Samuel or Kings or Chronicles or whatever. But he has this high priest with him, who's a good man. But remember, Samuel's old and he's a prophet. This man's the high priest. But Saul doesn't like the answers he's getting, and so he stopped seeking God. He was mobilized in a mood of depression and inactivity, which is something that was very natural to Saul. He lived in depression all the time. He had a demon of depression. Remember, David had been brought in and played for him when he was younger and on the lyre, and they would drive the evil spirit out of him, and he would be able to function for a while. But then at times it would rise up and capture him, and a couple times he actually tried to pin David to the wall with a spear while David was playing for him, since David was young. Jonathan, Saul's son, was a man of faith and action. He was actually a good guy. Rather than just sit around wringing his hands, he went with his armor bearer on a daring gambit, climbed up a dangerous cliff to a narrow pass between the two Philistine hills. The Jews were good in hills. They were good in the mountains. The Philistines liked to be down on the plains where they could use chariots and march in big, huge numbers and whatever, phalanxes. Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us. For the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by a few." He said, God can deliver us whether we have many or a few. Jonathan's vision, view of the world and his relationship to God in the world was more like David's and not like Saul's. Saul looked at the facts. See, looked at the numbers and Saul was always going to be outnumbered. Always. Israel was not that big of a people. And he was always going to be outgunned. Probably in his heyday, Solomon could put an army in the field that would match the size of his armies and his enemies. Maybe. And that's when Solomon had the biggest of all of Israel's armies. But Israel never came close to that in any other age. I mean, countries like Egypt or the Philistia or whatever, they had big standing armies. War was their life. And they had chariots and all that sort of thing. And they were well trained. Their standing armies were trained. Where the people hanging around Saul who were trained were 600 men, 1,000 here, 2,000 there. And when Israel went out to battle with 50,000 people, the rest of them were farmers with scythes, you know, machetes and stuff, pitchforks. So he was always going to be outnumbered. Abraham, remember, way back earlier, had gone up against the five kings of the mountains who had captured the four kings of the plains, including Lot. And Abraham went and chased after them to rescue Lot. and Abraham was 380 men against the armies of the five kings of the mountains. Gideon, earlier on in the book of Judges, was given to drive out the Philistines. And when he finally got an army together after a lot of hawing back and forth, he had 30,000 men, and the Lord told him to cut that down. So he sent all home but like 3,000. And God said, that's still too big. So he said, take the men down to the water, and those who lap up the water and with their eyes watch, you can keep them. Those who just bury their face in the water and drink, he said, you don't want them. And so he wound up with 300 men. So God whittled him down from 30,000 to 300 men to go up against this huge, massive army. And he did. God really likes us to understand that our success comes from him. And one of the ways that he does that a lot is cause the odds to be so overwhelmingly against us that when the victory comes, we know it's a miracle. And anybody who's done much study of our various world wars and stuff can tell you the kinds of things that happen when God's for us and the kinds of things that happen when God's not. You know, stuff like capturing the Enigma system during World War II that meant we had the German code for their secret trans. All manner of things that happened that are just like, if it hadn't gone that way, if it hadn't gone this way. If you watch the movie Midway, you know that the reason we actually found those seven carriers is because some guy disobeyed orders and went off track because he felt like he knew where the carriers were. I mean, if you watch that movie, you'll see that we spent hours and hours and all kinds of fuel in the air in a futile search to find these carriers. And our best minds had shown us where they ought to be. And we found them by accident because somebody else went off in another direction and found them. There was a man named George Gay, I think his name was. And he was one of the early people to spot them, and he got shot down early. And he landed in the water, and he had his life jacket on in the water. And he watched the entire Battle of Midway from the water. He was, it's a great story, it's a true story. But he saw all the stuff that went on there. He's just sitting there having a bird's eye view of whatever. You remember that one of the things that happened was is that the Japanese had come all the way from Pearl Harbor to Hawaii, and they had come through the North Sea, and which was sort of like not supposed to be able to be done. They had snuck their way all the way through, and we had suggestions that they were coming and all of that, but we ignored them because we didn't want to believe. And when they finally showed up over Oahu and began to do all that damage, it was a total shock, and it made us realize that all of our wisdom was not all that good. And we had very little. We were reduced from about 30,000 men to 300. Our fleet was reduced to very little, very, very little. And it was patched and put back together and whatever. Well, when the Japanese started off for Midway, when if they'd captured Midway, it would just been a stepping stone. Well, when they got to Midway, the commanders were all full of hubris. You know, they had come all the way across the North Sea. They had defeated the big giant, you know, just decisively. And they were going to just whip us up, you know, and full of it. And Yamamoto was concerned because he was more of a humble man. And he said, I've traveled throughout this country, and these people have enormous industrial might. And just because we wiped out their stuff doesn't mean that they're done. But their commanders didn't feel that way. So when they got ready to attack Midway, the commander in charge of this of the flyers on the planes on squadron leader, commander of squadrons, he wanted to send out his secondary men to go against Midway because he wanted to blood them. He wanted them to have success so that they would have like the first his primary men, his best flyers, so that these second hand guys these would have the same kind of sense of victory or whatever. So he said, we can send out our lesser guys because they can handle this. And so they go out over Midway, and their first strike is not decisive. Whereas if he'd sent out his best guys, they would have wiped us out in the first strike. And no one would have, when we got there, there wouldn't have been anybody to help. So their first strike didn't work. So then they came back and they said, well, we got to send out another round. So they landed on the deck, and then they put more bombs on to go back out to do a second round on Midway, which should have been unnecessary. And while they were getting ready to launch these, the Japs suddenly became aware that there were American planes in the air near them that suggested there had to be carriers nearby. And because there were carriers nearby, they were very afraid that they would be caught, you know, blindsided. So they dropped the bombs, they set them on the deck, and reloaded all these planes with torpedoes to go after the carriers. So when our guys got there and started bombing these ships, they were covered with their own bombs on the deck, and that's why 6 out of 7 of these things went down. Because it wasn't just that we hit them, but all their own bombs were there. There's so many things when you study our history, and you realize that when we are when we're small in our own personal strength, but large in our faith in God, that God meets us in miraculous ways. I mean, the Revolutionary War is just an example of that. But when we are big and mighty and powerful in our own mind, like in Vietnam, and we're just going to go in there and wipe everybody out, all of a sudden we get our head handed to us. After Vietnam, we decided maybe we could handle Grenada. You know, that was our biggie after Vietnam, until we got to Desert Storm. There's this whole history here. I mean, remember, when we study these books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, we're studying historical events as it relates to how the people related to God and the impact upon their lives. And we're meant to draw from that conclusions for ourselves. So when these people were walking with the Lord, then the fact that they were few in number and not heavily armed didn't matter, because God gave them victory. But when they got full of themselves, and they were not walking with the Lord, then they would get defeated over and over and over again. So Jonathan takes them to a narrow pass between two Philistine hills, he and his armor bearer. Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, let's see, I think I covered this part. All right, the armor bearer said to him, he said, the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by a few. The armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire. So the armor bearer was a man who, a young man apparently, as typically were, who admired Jonathan and trusted him. And he's I'm with you. Whatever you want to do, I'm with you. If you trust the Lord, I trust the Lord. Jonathan would have made a great king if he'd lived. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. And if they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, come to us, then we will go up, for the Lord will give them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us. So he said, we're going to expose ourselves, on the cliffs up here. When they see us, depending on what their response is to us, we'll know what God wants us to do. When both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, behold, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan, his armor bearer, and said, come up to us and we will tell you something. Duh. We got a secret, you know. Sounds like a conversation in the front seat of a Chevy, doesn't it? Yeah. Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up with me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer put them to death after him. So Jonathan would knock them down, and his armor bearer would put a sword, spear through them while they lay on the ground. The first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor made was about 20 men within about a half a furrow in an acre of land. So just in a big old field, acre field, at about half a row, he killed 20 men in there. And there was trembling in the camp and in the field among the people. And even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earthquake, so that it became a great trembling. So when word got back that there had been a slaughter, and then God began to shake the earth underneath the Philistines, and they assumed it was bad day in Big Rock. So God backed this victory. Yeah.
Is garrison just another word for like an army unit?
A garrison is a fort where troops are housed, but it's a temporary place. It's not like the main place where they live. So if you go out into the field, they build a garrison, and it's where they're housed. God backed up this victory with an earthquake that shook both the mountains and the Philistines' courage. You know, God has control over the natural forces. And more than one occasion, he has bent them to his purposes for the sake of his people, a la the Red Sea. You know. Now Saul's watch in Gibeah of Benjamin looked. So the watchman down in Gibeah looked. And behold, the multitude melted away, and they went here and there. So he was watching the Philistines, and all of a sudden he saw them scatter. Saul said to his people with him, "Number now and see who has gone from us. Somebody has caused this scattering. Figure out who it is." And when they numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. It'd be like, take a roll call, see who's missing. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. It happened while Saul talked to the priest that the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." And Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a great, very great confusion. Now the Hebrews with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in battle, so that the Lord delivered Israel that day. And the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. So, two guys go up and they get this started, and God starts shaking the earth, and the Philistines start panicking. And when Israel, then when Saul sees this, he calls his men out, takes the army, the ark of God forward, and the earthquakes increase. And the Philistines are afraid, and the Israelites are not. And all of the Israelites who were with the Philistines, these are servants, these are slaves or whatever, they rose up and began to kill their masters there in the battlefield. And then all the people from the surrounding communities heard about it, and they come rushing in, and there was a great victory achieved that day because Jonathan trusted the Lord. That's the story. Comments before we move on? You know, it's... we've talked about this before, but to write a book or to write in the ancient world was not something you did carelessly, because it was the paper, either targums, which were dried out sheepskins, or papyrus, which were very difficult to manage and to find, were precious. And so people didn't write. Most times writing was done in the houses of kings, etc., etc. And when these scriptures began to be written down, they were careful to only write what was necessary because writing was precious. Now we've got, you know, there's so much paper and stuff out there, and without, we only need paper now, so you can put out 87 bad books a day and it doesn't matter. But, you know, this was very precious what you wrote in these days. And a lot of times when you read the scriptures, like you'll tell the story of the prodigal son, okay, and you think, oh, that's probably about 4 pages. You read it and it's 2 paragraphs. Because it's written so tightly, because that's the way the scribes are taught to write. And there's not a lot of wasted stuff. So whenever they like repeat something, then you know that it's very important, because they felt it was strong enough to say it twice. Or when they give us these lists of descendants, you know they're there for a reason, because they wouldn't have wasted the paper if they hadn't been important. And so when these stories manage to find their way into the scripture, it means that God thinks they're important for us to understand. That's important for us to know. And so that's why we get these historical books of Judges, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Esther, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, all these historical books that are meant for us to understand the history of God and His people, so that we will learn from that. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, we talk about the Old Testament as the Hebrew Bible. It is, but it's not organized the same way. The Hebrew Bible ends with the writings. The Christian Bible, Old Testament, ends with the prophets. The Hebrew Bible ends with the writings. The last thing, the history books, the historical books. So that was the last thing that was appended to the Hebrew Bible was these historical books. They're even numbered differently than ours, which is why sometimes when you go into a Hebrew Bible, you're looking for a scripture, the numbers are sometimes different. Like, for instance, they didn't have a 1 and 2 Samuel, they had Samuel. They didn't have a 1 and 2 Kings, they had Kings. They had different names for the same books. Text was all the same, but. Now, the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food before evening until I have avenged myself on my enemies." Now, this is just a classic example of what happens when you have a bad king in charge. When you have someone whose head is not on straight, who's into themselves, or they're not following the Lord, or whatever, the people suffer whenever you have bad leadership. And it's why people should pray with a vengeance for good leadership, because you get stuck with what you get stuck with. Every once in a while, you'll be working somewhere, and you'll hear that you're getting bought by some other company. Well, you better pray that whoever buys you is a good person, because if you don't, whatever, you know, however bad you think it's been, it could get worse. Or, you know, sometimes you think, well, if I could just get rid of this boss, that'd be good. Well, that boss may be 10 times better than the one who comes after them. We'd far be far better off sometimes to learn to relate to whoever we have, as to pray away that boss to get a new one. So leadership is vital. And if we have good leadership, we benefit. And if we have bad leadership, we suffer. And God gives us the leadership we deserve. So we need to be serious in our prayer about leadership. So that day, the day of this battle, the men of Israel were hard-pressed. For Saul had issued an oath, had put people under oath saying that they would not eat anything until he was avenged on his enemies. Just a big, bold, stupid statement, you know. So none of the people had tasted food, and all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to the mouth, for the people feared the oath. So God had, on the forest, there was these just piles of honey. You know, bees were prolific in this area. And it was all there for the tasting. And honey is an energizer, as you know. And God had provided that for these people just to, you know, grab something as you go and keep going. And, you know, it's kind of like a power bar, you know, whatever. Five minute or whatever it is, energizer or whatever, 5 hour energizer. Five hour energizer. Yeah, 5 minute energizer is it. It's a cookie or a piece of cake, you know. 5 minutes and psh, you're down. But anyway, you know, bread. But there was honey on the ground, and the people entered the forest, and there was a whole flow of honey. But no man would put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. Now, remember that Jonathan gets this thing started, and then the Philistines, a big army of Philistines, they start to get all confused and whatever, and then Saul brings his 600 in, and the thing gets worse, and they get confused. And then the people in the local community hear about it, and they come out in droves to help to do this. And this, for 600 and another maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, to slaughter all this big army, it takes all day. I mean, this is all day, okay? Now, they haven't eaten for 24 hours. And so they get out there, and they get into all this, and they need food. But Saul had decreed that no one should eat. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people on the oath, because he was up on the mountain, you know. Therefore, he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand, dipped it in the honey, put it in his mouth, and his eyes brightened. In other words, his energy level came up. Then one of the people answered and said, "Your father strictly put the people under the oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food today.'" And the people were weary. Then Jonathan said, "Well, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have been brightened, how much energy I have because I taste all this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, for now they the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great." If he had just allowed the people to eat, they would have had enough energy and we could have wiped out a whole big bunch more of them instead of just wounding them. Jonathan said, "My father is unwise to do this." They struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very weary, and the people rushed really upon the spoil. So once the Philistines had been wiped out, pushed back, and a lot of them lay dead, then all their stuff is laying there, that are their goods and whatever, and all their sheep and goats. And remember, this is an army. They've got food with them. And the people are starved. And so they rushed gleefully upon the spoil. They took the sheep and the oxen and the calves. They slew them on the ground and began to eat them with the blood. Remember, they were not supposed to. They were supposed to cook and kill kosher and whatever. But these people were starved, and they just start hacking them open and have a little steak tartare right there on the spot because And then they told Saul, saying, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today." Saul said to disperse yourselves among people. Say to them, "Each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood." So all the people that night brought each one his ox with them, and they slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was his first altar that he built to the Lord. So his lack of wisdom is showing up early and often. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them till the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Well, whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, saying, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into the hand of Israel?" But God did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Draw near, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, whoever delivers Israel, though it is my son Jonathan, he shall surely die." So God was not answering his question, and Saul is discerning that someone has disobeyed the Lord, and that's the reason why God is not answering his question. And he particularly is thinking of the oath that he put everybody under. So he said, "Whoever's broken the oath will die, because they've not kept the oath, and God is therefore not blessing us." But not one of all the people answered him. Then he said to all of Israel, "You shall be on my side, one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Well, whatever seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Now, the casting of lots. You all remember that when you study Leviticus and also in Deuteronomy, you get a very detailed description of the tabernacle and the high priest and their dress and whatever. And you remember the high priest had an outer garment he put over top of his tunic, and it had all kinds of stuff on it, but it had a huge pocket on the front. And in that pocket were two stones named Urim and Thummim. And that translates into lights and perfection. And when they would cast lots, although there are many ways to cast lots, but when they would cast lots, they would reach in, the high priest would reach in, and if it pulled out, it was like heads or tails. If they pulled out one stone, it was go do this, and if they pulled out the other one, it was don't. It was a yes or no. So he says here, let there be a perfect lot. In other words, let perfection come up. The humum. Okay? So he's using the casting of lots as a mechanism to determine whether the sin was in his house or if it was in the house of all the people. Now, if it had fallen on the people, then he would have divided them by groups until he found the guilty party. happens a lot in the Old Testament. Cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. And then Jonathan was taken. So the lot said that Jonathan was the one. And then Saul said to Jonathan, what have you done? So Jonathan told him, he said, I indeed tasted a little of honey with the end of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die. He said, you got me. I did it, you're right. I broke the thing. So I submit myself to your punishment. And Saul said, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die. Now, this may God do this to me and more also is a sort of a short form version of a curse. And basically what it says is, may God destroy me if I do not obey him in this particular thing. Okay. It's used a lot in the Old Testament when people are swearing to one another. May God do this to me and more also. You'll know, remember that whenever they would make covenant between peoples, that the verb for a covenant, the noun is benai, and the verb is berith, benai berith. It means to cut. So covenants were cut. They weren't promulgated, or whether they were cut. That was the verb they used. Because they would take an animal, depending on who the parties were. If it was poor people, they would cut a lamb in half. If it was rich people, they'd cut an ox in half. And if they were really poor, they'd take two pigeons, one dead, one both dead. And then the two parties would walk between the two animals. And they would say, may God do this to me and more if I do not keep this covenant. If I break this covenant, may God do this, what we've done to these animals, may God do this to me and more. Okay? So that phraseology is a form of curse. It says, I put upon myself a curse that if I don't do this, may God destroy me. Saul, who's all heated up with his hubris and whatever, he had said earlier, he said, if it turns out to be Jonathan, whoever's done it, they have to die. And so when Jonathan turns up, he said, may God destroy me if I don't do what I said. But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die who has brought us this great victory at Israel? Far from it, as the Lord lives, there shall be no one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. They stood up to the king and told him to back off. See, already we're saying that this king has no respect. This king has no real authority. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went up in their own place.
So the people rescued Jonathan?
Yep.
How did they do that?
They stood up to the king, and they said, no, you're not going to kill him. I mean, basically what they're saying is, over my dead body.
So before they were saying, whatever you want. And then when it comes to this...
Well, when it came to this, they said, Jonathan is the one who brought us this victory. See, the thing of the matter is they respect Jonathan. Mm-hmm. And they see Jonathan as a man of God. And they see Jonathan as a man of... Saul was not a wimp. And he was not a fearful man. He was a great warrior. But he had no sense for God whatsoever. And therefore, he had no sense. Mm-hmm. His wisdom was, he was...
But he thought he did.
Huh? Well, just like Washington today, Yeah, they're absolutely sure they know what they should do. They're absolutely sure they're right, but they have no sense.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what happens when we get the leadership we deserve because we deserve the leadership we get. Okay? When in Isaiah, when the Lord is talking about what happens when the people fall away from him, he says, I will remove from you your statesmen. I will take away from you all of your nobles. And he said, you will be governed by women and boys. People of inexperience, people with no understanding about how things ought to be. And in that culture, being governed by a woman was a horrible thing. You can't take 21st century political correctness and impose it back on those people. Because the fact of the matter is 21st century political correctness only got that way in the last century, because prior to that time, at any rate, when Maggie Thatcher came into to become prime minister over there, it was an event. We've had queens in history, and some of them have done that, but they've been the exception. So God said to the people in Isaiah's day, I will make your leaders inexperienced people, people with no authority. If you do not follow after me, I will give you bad leadership. And then that will lead you into trouble. The Israelites give up further chasing the Philistines. the Philistines escape, and the victory is diminished. Everyone knows it was Saul's fault. Saul was tall and handsome, a good warrior, and pretty. But his good looks do not make him a good king. Saul looks like Troy Donahue, but governs like Phil Donahue. Some of you are old enough to know that. Saul's continual failures of leadership lead to his increasingly crippling insecurity. Israel thought they knew what they wanted. They wanted a big, pretty boy king and a warrior and somebody who they could be proud to follow and whatever. And God wanted them to trust him. But they insisted. And he said, okay, I'm going to give you what you want. And so he gave him the prettiest man he could find. Big and tall and a warrior. No doubt about that. But this man was not a good leader. So they got the leadership they deserved. Now, had he lived, Jonathan would have succeeded him, and Jonathan would have been a much better man. He was a much better man. But as you know, he didn't live. So God brought them David. David was a much better king. But there was a lesson learned, or to be learned here. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab and Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger was Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw a mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to a staff. So Saul was a good king in terms of battle and leading people to war, and he was willing to do the fighting. And he did stand up for the people, and he drove their enemies away. Nobody's all bad. Nobody's all good. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, listen to the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel. Now he set himself against him on the way while he was coming out for Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek, and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, and child and infant, and ox and sheep and camel and donkey." Then Samuel summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. Saul came to the city of the Amalek and set an ambush in the valley, and Saul said to the Kenites, "Go and depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them, for you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt." Now the Kenites were the descendants of Jethro, who was the son of Midian. And they were dwelling among the Amalekites at this particular point in time. They were friendly with Israel as a history. And Saul told them, "You need to get out of there because I'm getting ready to wipe everybody else out." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen, the fatlings, and the lambs, and all that was good. They were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. So God said to them, "I'm going to give you a victory over the Amalekites, because when you came up from out of Egypt, they attacked, before you even got to Sinai, the Amalekites had attacked them, and God had to organize them together in battle and give them victory, miraculous victory over the Amalekites. And God said, I'm going to punish the Amalekites now for what they did then. So I want you to go up against them, because they're pressing in. They're trying to, there's raiding parties and stuff. So I want you to go up against them, and I want you to wipe them out. Every man, woman, and child, dog, cat, everything. All of it. It's all of it's going to be, in effect, a sacrifice to me. Wipe it all out. You're going to go up against them, and you're not going to take booty or spoil. You're just going to wipe it all out in obedience to me. Now, one of the things people liked about warfare was it's a good way to get rich. Always has been. Warfare is very often conducted by people from afar who got rich on it. One of the things that Kennedy was concerned about, and Johnson picked it up from Kennedy, really, and they got it from Eisenhower, was Eisenhower's warning as he left the office that the military-industrial complex had grown to the point that it had to have war to sustain itself. By that, he meant the companies who built tanks and guns and missiles and all that sort of thing, the military-industrial complex. And he said they had grown to the point that they couldn't survive in peacetime, and they had to have war, and that they must be guarded against for getting us into unnecessary wars. And he told them to watch the generals, because the generals were all being enriched by the industrial military complex. One of the operating theories of why Kennedy was assassinated was because of this, because the military-industrial complex didn't want him around. Because when Kennedy came in, he threw a big old blanket over all that, and he wasn't a Republican, a general like Eisenhower. He was a liberal from Massachusetts, didn't want war, etc., etc. He'd been in war and he'd seen what it was like. He didn't want. Anyway, when people went out to war in these days, very often there was no pay for it. You see, these people just came. Saul said, "Come running," and they came, brought their swords and their sons and their donkeys are riding on, and their own supplies, their own food. It wasn't like there was a military canteen around. In fact, you remember the stories of when the Philistines were up against Goliath. I mean, when Israel was up against Goliath and the Philistines during the early days of Saul, when David was a shepherd in the fields, that David's older brothers were in the army with Saul, and one of David's jobs was to go up on a monthly basis and replenish their supplies. They had to have food, and they wouldn't have had it if his family hadn't sent it to them. So these soldiers, they came with their own army, the armor, they came with their own food, their own supplies, they brought their sons, that's how they operated. I remember when I was a young kid seeing my mother putting together boxes of fruitcakes and cookies and stuff and sending them to Korea to my uncle, because they had K rations, but they wouldn't have anything good to eat if we hadn't sent them that kind of stuff. So, when a battle was won, then the benefit was is whatever was laying on the ground was yours. It was the spoils. It was the booty. And people become very wealthy in battle. Some people just made their entire fortune because it just happened to who they wind up killing and who they happened to be around when they spotted gold and this and that and the other thing. Now, y'all remember, I'm sure, that in Jane Austen's England, which was, 1700s or 1800s, we still had the nobility. We had those people who were born to money and those people who were not. And the nobility were 10, 20, 30% maybe of the population. And everybody else served, lived under the nobility. The lord of the manor was responsible for, as a lord over all his people, he handled all of the small claims court stuff and whatever, and the people farmed on his land, and then they brought up produce as a share, and if he had a son, he built a manor house for the son. If he had a mother, he built a dower house for the mother, and the family lived high, and everybody else lived how they lived. And if you watched Downton Abbey, you've seen this, okay? Well, always on the Lord's manor, they would have a church, because these are good Christian people, so they would have a church. And generally speaking, the second oldest son of the lord of the manor would become the vicar for the church, because the church had a living. There was a tithe that came into the church from the people, and it became the living. And the lord of the manor would subsidize the living so that there would be a nice income for whoever was the vicar. Sometimes men were unwilling to be vicars because they couldn't keep their mistresses aligned enough in order to be vicar. So they would hire a curate to take their spot for a lesser fee. So a curate was somebody who took the place of a vicar who didn't want to fill the post. And they were hired, whereas the vicar got the living. I mean, he still got the living, it came to him as his way of earning money. And sometimes the vicar was 8 years old, and that had to have somebody manage the church until he got big enough and could go to school. And so they had a curate. So that's the difference between a curate and a vicar. When we were on our trip in England, out in the countryside, we saw churches that had the vicar here, the curate here. Some of them had vicars, some had curates. Well, what do you do with the third son? What do you do with the third son and noble families who can't be the lord of the manor and can't be a vicar? What you do is you send them off to the Navy when they're about 12. And what happens is they are trained in naval warfare. And at age 12 or 13, they are given authority over men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s because they're of noble birth. Now, some of you all have seen Master and Commander, which was a really great show. Russell Crowe was the star of the thing, but it's like Horatio Hornblower. There's all these stories that are written by the British about their great sea captains. Well, if you've seen Master and Commander, it's a nice show. It's on TV from time to time. You'll notice that there's these kids on there who are about 12, 13, or 14, and they are put in charge of all these seamen who are much older than them because they come from noble families. Now, some of them can handle it and some of them can't, as you see from the show. What happens is that as they grow older, they move up the line to become captains of ships, and ships' jobs are to go out and capture other ships that are not our ships, and whenever they capture a ship, that ship is hauled into port, it is sold off, and the goods and the wealth of it is spread out and down through the ranks, and men became very wealthy by going to war, by either war or on the ocean or on the land. So the way that the third son typically, or some nobleman's son who maybe was a lesser nobleman and didn't have a whole lot, was to send their children to war, their sons, at an age of 12, 13, 14 years of age, and then let them move up in rank until they become wealthy. Now, if you're a Jane Austen fan like I am, you've seen the movie Persuasion. And in the movie Persuasion, you have a story about a noble family, and you know, there's a lot going on here, but the middle daughter had fallen in love with this young seaman, and the mother has died, and the family is being guided by the mother's best friend, who's a nearby noble lady, and the father's an imbecile, and the older daughter is not good either. And so this lady, who the friend of the mother's, encourages the father to break off this relationship between this girl and this young seaman, who's a nobleman. He'll never amount to much. Well, so what happens is she winds up becoming the old maid's sister who's caring for everybody else. She becomes kind of a family slave. And then, years later, this young seaman comes back, but now he's a captain, and he's wealthy. And what happens is there's this whole process about whether they can get together or not and whatever. But it really gives you a good feel for this whole thing about how people get wealthy at war. And whenever battles like this were fought, one of the things that brought a lot of people out was this incredible opportunity to get wealthy. Because when they go in and wipe out cities and peoples and stuff like that, all the goods are laying there on the ground. Well, every once in a while, God would say, like he did at Ai when they first crossed over. Remember, he gave them Jericho. And after Jericho, he said, I want you to go up against the city of Ai. He said, when you're in Jericho, all the spoil belongs to me. This is the first victory in the land. And all the spoil belongs to me. No one's to take any spoil from Jericho. Now, after my tithe is paid, then when you go up against other cities, you'll get the spoil. In fact, when they got to the promised land, they inherited houses they didn't build and vineyards they didn't plant and wealth was just handed to them. They all got rich. But when they came to Jericho, they were not to touch anything. And there was a man whose name was Achan. And Achan found some precious treasures, some gold things, and he hid them away in his knapsack, took them home, and buried them under his tent. And so next week, they went to this town called Ai, and they got whipped. And they began to fuss at God because they'd gotten whipped. And, Moses told them, after he prayed the Lord, you got whipped because you were disobedient to me in Jericho. Joshua, not Moses. was gone. So what happened is they had to figure out who in Jericho had done all this, had done this, and so they cast lots by tribe, and then they cast lots by family of the tribe, and they finally came to Achan. And they said, "What have you done?" And he said, "Well, I found some really good stuff, and I captured it and took it, and it's hidden in the floor of my tent." And so God decreed that Achan and his wife and his children should all be stoned to death. And then they piled up a huge cairn of rock over top of them, and it became known as the Valley of Achor from that day, because they had disobeyed God's command that all the booty belonged to him. Well, in this particular battle, he says to them, "You're going up against the Amalekites. I'm going to give you significant victory. And all the booty belongs to me, and I want you to destroy it all. Just destroy it. That's the command." So the people, they got up there. God gave them the victory against this huge group of people. But they began to be selective about what they would keep and what they would not keep. And when they saw the really good breeding stock and some of the really good stuff, and, you know, they were able, they wiped out all of the, you know, old women, the ugly women, the old men, whatever, and all the warriors. But if they saw some, you know, really nubile young maid, they said, "Well, it'd be a shame to wipe that out." So they take her home and make her a servant and find some use for her somewhere. And they captured all of the best stuff and they kept it to themselves. And Saul was right at the head of it because he allowed King Agag to live, because in the world Saul was in, a real king was known to have conquered kings at his table. They would cut off their thumbs and toes so that they couldn't resist anymore, and then they would feed them all the days of their life at their table. And whenever someone would come up to visit a king, they would say, see my conquered kings. They were like trophies. And so Saul said, "This would be a really good opportunity for me to pick up a conquered king." You know. In fact, when we read through the Kings and Chronicles, you're going to run across a story where we'll say, "And this guy had 17 kings at his table with no thumbs and no toes, no big toes." You know. It was, you know, everybody keeps score a different way, right? Remember, I got an elbow. Remember that, you know? I got an elbow. Well, first base, second base, third base. I actually touched her elbow. Woo! Oh. That's the way they used to keep score when we were young and innocent, you know? I got an elbow. Wow. Alrighty. You see the guy, and he's there in the movie theater, and he's taking his hand, he's putting it around, and he's just like this, and he's going to see whether or not she'll let him put the arm around, and smack, oh, it didn't work out. Didn't get to first base. You know. But, you know, if she let him put the arm around or whatever, he'd say, "I got an elbow, man, I got a shoulder." Of course, he usually enhanced it pretty well. But anyway, instead of doing what God told them to do, they disobeyed him. Now, God had spared the Kenites, who are Midianites related to Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. The Kenites were living among the Amalekites at that time. The Kenites had been allies to Israel since before the Exodus, and the Kenites leave the encampment as Saul directs. So Saul wipes out the Amalekites, except for King Agag, and he spares the best of the spoils for his own purposes. He decides he's wiser than God about such matters, and he turns out yet to be another great blunder by Saul. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, "I regret that I've made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me, has not carried out my commands." Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night, and Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul. And it was told Samuel, saying, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he has set up a monument for himself, and then turned and proceeded on down to Gilgal." So Samuel's upset now because his king is acting ugly. But he's going to fight God for him. He's going to be messianic. He's going to stand up for him and say, "You know, Lord, don't kill him." Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. Blessed are you. I have carried out the command of the Lord. I've done what the Lord told me to do." But Samuel said, "Well, what then is this bleating of sheep in my ears?" If you've carried out all the Lord do, then how come I hear sheep bleating and the lowing of oxen that I hear? If you did all the Lord said, how come I hear oxen lowing? And Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice the Lord your God, but the rest we've utterly destroyed. Now this is an outright lie. It wasn't that the people spared them to sacrifice to the Lord. It's just that he's now covering his tracks pretty fast as he can go. Samuel said to Saul, wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And Saul said, then we'll speak. And Samuel said, is it not true, speaking for the Lord, is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head over the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission, and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rush upon the spoil, and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord, and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, the king of the Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people took some of the spoil, and the sheep and the oxen, choice of things devoted to destruction and sacrifice to our God at Gilgal. The people did it. And Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, it is better to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Now, underline that. That is what that echoes. David quotes this. If it was rams and lambs you wanted, I would have given them to you. What you want is a contrite heart and obedient man. This echoes down through the scriptures. That as the Lord as much delight in religion as he does in relationship. As the Lord is much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, as is obeying the voice of the Lord, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. God gave them all kinds of mechanisms for worship, including rams and lambs and all that kind of stuff. But those are meant to be metaphors for devotion. And if you have the metaphor but not the devotion, then they're worthless metaphors. To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, divination, witchcraft. And insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. So disobedience is worse than any idolatry or witchcraft that you might come up with. Now, Samuel has given us a very important perspective that says what God wants from us is relationship, obedience, our hearts. Not religion, not sacrifices, not stuff. You know, this is sort of hidden here in the midst of the history books, but it's one of the most important things that God ever says to any of us. Because you rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. He said, you're done. He doesn't mean you're done tonight, but he means you're done. Behold, to obey is better than due religion, to heed is better than the fat of rams. All right. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now, if you can just kind of move forward in history and listen to what happens when David gets confronted with his sin and compare it to Saul's response, you'll see the difference. Saul, he offers excuses and passes the blame and the whole nine yards. And then when he's totally caught out, he says, you know, you're right, I sinned. David goes down immediately and says, you're right, I'm wrong, I sinned. I deserve whatever comes upon it. And God says, I like that guy. I like that guy. Well, think about it. When you're dealing with a son and you know he's done something wrong, or a daughter or whatever, don't you love it when they just fess right up as opposed to pass on one lie after another lie after another lie? One morning we woke up and our car was gone. And Nancy's purse was kind of rifled in the kitchen. And there were keys laying on the driveway. And so Jeremy was over. He had a friend. They spent the night. And so we called the police, and the police came, and right behind the police came a wrecker with our car, and it was on an angle as it came down the road. And so the policeman said, you got any teenage boys living in your house? I said, yeah, I got a couple. Well, Todd came out the front door. He said, is that your son? I said, yeah. And he said, that's who took your car. And I said, no, he didn't take my car. And he said, well, I'm telling you, this is an inside job. One of your sons took your car and wrecked it and whatever. And he said, if I were you, I would not file a complaint on this just yet. Because if we have to pursue it, it could get your child in trouble. So I said, well, whatever, but I don't think that's right. Well, about that time, Jeremy and his friend come out and they're going, gosh, what happened here? Well, it didn't take long to figure out that the night before, Jeremy and his friends had taken the car and gone for a joyride, and they were going through one part of San Antonio, and they got off the road and got up on a hill and went airborne and came down and landed on the front axle. And the car was done. They couldn't drive it anymore. So then they get out of the car. They break off the key in the ignition like it was supposed to mean something. They come home, and they're covered in mud because they're walking across all this stuff, and they clean all their clothes up and whatever and make all this stuff go on. And then pretend, you know, I mean, I bet you they were there. I bet they got to bed about 30 minutes before we woke up. Because this is an all-night deal trying to cover this up. Well, it didn't take me long to figure out what was going on. And so I confronted Jeremy and I said, you know, you need to fess up to this. Oh, no. We didn't do anything whatsoever. And next day, no, we didn't do anything whatsoever. So I finally said to Jeremy, I will not speak to you again until you tell me the truth. Don't even approach me. So he came to me later and he said, Dad, I said, not unless you're willing to tell me the truth. And he went away. And finally he came back and said, all right, you're right, I did it. So we dealt with all that. When your son doesn't fess up, runs you through all these hoops and all this kind of stuff, you don't appreciate that, and neither does God. I mean, it's not like God doesn't know what happened. I think we have to be comfortable when we're sinners, to quickly confess to God that we're sinners, because He knows. I mean, if nothing else, it's strategically, He knows. Okay? But the whole point is to honor God at least by confessing and owning it up. We need to be get comfortable with the fact that we're going to need to repent to God from time to time for this or that thing, and the sooner the better. So he said, I've sinned, I've indeed transgressed the command of the Lord in your words, because I feared the people and I listened to their voice. You know, the people wanted to keep all this stuff and I was afraid of them and I just let it happen. He still can't get it straight. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. We're done. And as Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe and it tore. It ripped. Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from your hand today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. Just the way you tore my garment, the Lord has torn the kingdom from your hand today. And he has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. Also, the glory of God will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. The glory of God means God. The glory of Israel means God. He said, your God is not going to change his mind. He's not a man that he should do that. And then he said, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people, before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Then Samuel said, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Agag came to him cheerfully, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. In other words, I've escaped death. You know, I've been captured and whatever. But obviously, I'm going to be able to live. I may not have thumbs when I get done, but I'll be able to live. Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Well, the Amalekites, you know, had raided camps and gutted pregnant women, and I mean, this wasn't, you know, there's nobody, there's not somebody burping in church, you know, this is blood and guts and gore and whatever. Then Samuel went to Ramah, but Saul went up to his house at Gibeah, and Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. For Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. Now, when it says that Samuel did not see him again until the day of his death, he means it. And the day that Samuel died, the day that Saul died, Samuel had been dead already for years. And we'll read the story, but he goes to a witch to try to get a hold of Samuel so he can get some help. And God brings Samuel back to confront him and said, "Today you will be with me in death." So, okay, we're going to move on here a little bit. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul since I rejected him being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons." Samuel was a like any other messianic leader, and that is that he loved his people, even though they were sinners. And he often stood to defend them, even though they didn't deserve it. Remember that on a number of occasions, God said to Moses, "You just get out of the way. I'm going to wipe these people out and start over. We'll get you a couple of wives and whatever, and it'll take a little while, but we'll get another tribe going." And Moses bowed down before him and said, don't do these people and whatever. And he said things like, "You know, if you do that, the people are going to say you couldn't deliver your people." I mean, he leveraged God with all kinds of stuff, which God liked, by the way. And God knew he was going to do, by the way. But he was a messianic figure. He laid his life down for his people. He was willing to put himself at risk for the sake of his people. Moses did that. Daniel did that. Samuel does that. Joshua does that. There are certain their nature of leaders is that many of them are messianic, meaning they are willing to die so that others might live, like Harry Potter. Okay, that's the messianic temperament. So he said, God said to Samuel, "I want you to quit moaning and grieving over Saul. That's done. It's time for us to move on." Saul is disappointed that Samuel's disappointed that Saul didn't do well. I mean, he loved the man. You know, he wanted him to succeed. So he said, "I want you to go over to Jesse's house." And Samuel said, "How can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. If he hears that I've gone up to Bethlehem to find a new replacement king, he'll send an assassin squad and take me out." The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I've come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you what you should do. And you shall anoint for me one of the, for whom I have I designate to you. So go up under the pretense that you're going to do a sacrifice and invite Jesse to come to your table." So Samuel did what the Lord said and came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the city came trembling to him and said, "Do you come in peace?" Because when the prophet shows up, he's either coming with good news or bad news. And remember, this is a guy who just hewed Agag to pieces with a sword. Samuel was no wussy. So they said, "Did you come in peace or are we in trouble?" And he said, "I come in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. That's where we're going to stop. So he's going up to Bethlehem to anoint a new king. Now this is before Saul is dead. It's long before Saul is dead. The anointing is going to take place many years before this man can be king. In fact, he's going to anoint a youth. Okay? He's going to anoint David. And we'll get to that story next week. I love the humanity of all these people. You know, I love Samuel being disappointed in Saul and upset and being willing to ask God, "Well, give him another chance," you know, that kind of thing. I love the fact that none of these leaders are perfect and that they have flaws. I mean, there's nothing here to suggest that Saul's going to hell. You see what I'm saying? We have a tendency to think sometimes that either all good or you're all bad. There's nothing here to suggest that Saul's going to hell. Saul worships God. He's just not real obedient, and he's all full of himself, and he doesn't have his relationship with God right. He's very religious. There's nothing to suggest that he's going to hell. So when we read these stories and we see, now you're going to see some people who are going to go to hell, but there's some good kings, some bad kings. There's some really bad kings. But you're going to see a lot of people who are just flawed. They're just flawed. And you're going to see a lot of good people make mistakes. And you're going to see a lot of bad people who get redeemed. Because that is real life before God. One of the greatest kings who ever lived, Josiah, made a huge mistake and got himself killed. And one of the worst men who ever lived, Manasseh, was thrown in jail, and while he was in jail, he repented, and God fully restored him and received him. And he had killed Isaiah. And he had killed, offered his sons to Moloch. He was that bad. And yet, when he repented, God forgave him. So, one of the things we need to see in these stories is humanity, because they're like us. And we can get some advice from it, and we can take some courage from it. Because the advice is that, you know, you can act dumb or smart. Why not? Let's act smart. The encouragement is that even if we act dumb, there's restoration that's possible if we will repent like we should. If we can learn from our mistakes and grow. That's why these seven or eight books are in here, the last books of the Jewish Bible. History, big history, goes from, somewhere around 1400 BC all the way to the time of Christ. 1400 years of human history between God and his people Israel that demonstrates that we need to walk with God and not live according to all these human wisdoms and stuff that we have. Comments? Okay, somebody press out.